Hey, welcome to F This Movie, you maniacs. My name is Patrick Bromley. I'm joined tonight by the biggest monkey I know, JB.
And we're going to be a little bit quieter now because we're crouching in a cornfield and we're very worried that they're going to come and harvest us. I still remember that sound
really? From
the first time I saw the movie on the CBS Wednesday night movie. I thought that was the perfect noise
for when the apes come.
Yeah.
It's the ape siren. You can find our website at fthismovie.net. Podcasts, articles, reviews, lists, stuff. Check it out. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/fthismovie. I'm excited because we just broke 500 Facebook likes, and I think it'll take us another 5 years to get to 600 because people aren't really on Facebook anymore, so it's kind of dead. Twitter.com/fthismovie, and you can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. You can also find us every week at dvdverdict.com, thanks to Michael Saley and everybody at DVD Verdict. And while you're there, go ahead and browse one of the tens of thousands of reviews, and if you see something you like, click on the Amazon links and support DVD Verdict.
And on iTunes, do not leave us negative feedback, you damn dirty ape.
Now, see, you're just going to get somebody who's going to do it out of spite, just to show you.
Damn it, it's that reverse psychology thing of your generation that I just can't wrap my mind around.
So we're going to talk about Planet of the Apes, the original 1968 movie, not the brilliant reimagining by Sir Tim Burton. He was knighted, by the way. He was not knighted.
Oh my God. I just threw up a little bit in my mouth.
I was thinking about that, the remake today, and I'm pretty sure that was where the term reimagining started. So now I have another reason to hate that movie.
And I thought Tim Burton's reimagining of Planet of the Apes is where we got, what spawned the term universally reviled.
Yeah. That's a movie that everybody saw and nobody liked.
Oh, man. Because it's come up on the website in several different ways. It was part of a early Shitting on the Classics column about remakes. Every so often, someone will bring it up in the comments, and it's like, F this movie kryptonite.
Everybody's seen it. Nobody likes it. Anyway, so we're going to be talking about the original. But first, I have to ask, JB, have you seen anything good lately?
Yes. And I'm so proud. Because being part of F this movie means that sometimes you go see a movie and you think it's one thing and then you find out it's another thing and you're like, gee, am I the only person who thinks this? And then you listen to the podcast about Spring Breakers.
Oh.
And I went to see it over spring break and I was expecting X and I got oranges. I think, and I'm not a fan of Harmony Korine. I'm not.
I don't think I am either, but I haven't seen enough of his stuff.
I said this to your lovely wife the other night. It's the most interesting film I've seen this year.
Yeah.
And I'm taking another line from you. James Franco, and I'm a reasonable James Franco fan. I'm not a rabid James Franco fan, but largely I like his work.
You're a bit of a Francophile.
Because I haven't seen Oz yet, because I'm waiting for that to get to the patio on that big screen.
Next week.
Yeah, day after tomorrow. James Franco in Spring Breakers, way to commit to the bit.
Yeah, right?
That defines fearless performance.
That's the kind of performance that Nicolas Cage used to do. When Nicolas Cage was really great, you'd go see it and like, wow, he's on another planet, that guy.
I would even maintain that Big Daddy in...
the movie Big Daddy?
No.
Oh.
In Kick-Ass.
Oh, right.
Is sort of the last of...
Maybe, yeah.
The good...
Right.
Weird ones.
He pops up every once in a while.
So I went to see Spring Breakers, and it was interesting because the other day I brought it up in class, and my class could not believe that I had gone to see it, but none of them had.
Interesting.
Because, and again, your wife shared this with me, part of the genius of the film is the marketing campaign that makes you believe it's one of those.
Right.
It's a critique.
But then everybody comes out of it hating it, at least of a certain age group, and that's going to kill the word of mouth.
Very much like Magic Mike, where there was no place in this film to masturbate. And Dana Stevens, who someone has informed me I bring up way too much, so I'll stop, said that at the show she saw, which I'm assuming was in New York, there were men who came in with raincoats.
For real?
and it didn't come across as her being hyperbolic. Yeah, it seemed like it was just Ray Portage.
I felt bad enough going into the movie, you know? Like, I felt like I was being judged for going into the movie. But then I felt better coming out of it, because I was like, I got to see art, you fuckers.
Here was my audience. I will remember this for a couple weeks. Lots of single men sitting by themselves. I went at 10 in the morning.
Oh, God.
So you're lonely, you're horny, and you're out of a job, apparently. And they're all sitting by themselves, and then me, and then two drunk girls, and their best friend guy, and they're obviously drunk, and they keep screaming to each other about how much fun it is to call in sick and get drunk and go to a movie.
That's a nightmare.
I don't know about that. I thought it kind of made it more fun. But then over my spring break transition,
nice.
My son and I went downtown and saw the movie No.
Okay.
And I'm not sure if this is being publicized, but for a while I was going to Landmark Century a lot, and I just kept seeing the trailer. And then I read a review, once again, Dana Stevens, who said she doesn't think she'll see a better film all year. It was made in Chile. I believe in Chile it was released last year. It is about when Pinochet's regime was being seen as a dictatorship all around the world. And so he decided to put it to a vote. Should we keep Pinochet, who was a dictator, or should we go with something else? And the opposition to Pinochet actually, the movie's based on truth. It's a drama, but it's based on reality. In fact, at some points, he blends real and video footage of the time. They hired an advertising consultant, a modern advertising consultant, to do the campaign for No.
Mm-hmm.
No to Pinochet. And it's an amazing film. I think it's a masterpiece. I would recommend that everyone see it, however you can. I always forget the gentleman's name. He's in Motorcycle Diaries and Y Tu Mama Tambien and Gael Garcia
Bernal.
Yeah. Amazing performance. I know my son had seen him in other things. We went in not knowing what to expect, which doesn't happen very much anymore.
Yeah.
It's great. And then I was all set to go to the Music Box, which is once again the happiest place on earth, to see Room 237. Because it's this documentary that I was very interested in. And then I discovered it was on Comcast pay-per-view. So I ponied up and I watched it. And obviously your mileage may vary, but I was so glad I did. It's awful.
There will be a column about it next week from Adam Risky. And I don't want to give away his feelings about the movie, but you guys may see eye to eye.
I was expecting, because I've actually read critical essays about the film, where people discover interesting things, and obviously Kubrick was this chess-playing, puzzle-loving genius. And I could never find it again on the internet, but someone did a study of the way the numbers work in the movie, because they changed the room number from the book. In the book, it's 217. And Kubrick explained why, but it turns out that explanation is a lie, so why did he change? And I thought there would be serious theories to balance out the kooks. It's just kooks. And you sort of have to admire the fact that the filmmakers let them speak. And give us credit, there's no editorializing or funny music or voiceover. It is a parade of kooks of people who have watched this film way too many times. And I found it very disappointing.
I haven't seen the movie, and I still kind of want to, even though now two people on this site have panned it, so I probably won't. But I feel like in order to work, it does need to present some theories about the movie that you can wrap your head around.
Because a great film.
But also because otherwise, it's how long can you sit and listen to somebody saying things that you just completely don't agree, that are crazy? How long can you listen to crazy people talk about nonsense?
Especially if you know how films are made.
Right.
But I think because I didn't know what to expect, what kept me sitting through it is I kept waiting.
Right.
For the voice of reason.
Right.
There is none.
What a more... I just feel like a more effective movie... Again, I haven't seen the movie. It just sounds like a more effective movie would have tried to balance the two to make the argument it's a spectrum and you can read it this way or you can go so far out and be this guy and aren't all the conversations about film interesting that happen in between.
And in no way do I want to spoil Adam's column because, and I think I speak for all of us, Adam is a tremendous asset to the site, and I've been enjoying every single one of his columns. I really like the stuff he did. In fact, that last one about the D-Box scenes and everything was amazing. I really like his work.
Yeah. Speaking of that, I will bring up the movie that he talked about in D-Box because I saw G.I. Joe Retaliation, and I probably shouldn't have.
I even figured out when you saw it. Because you published the reassessment of the original.
Yeah.
And then someone asked you, and the day it opened, you commented on that comment, and I said,
I did.
That SOB went Thursday night. He went Thursday night.
It's not good, and that's not to say that the first movie is good, but again, the first movie sort of knows what it is, and this movie takes itself very seriously, and I'm not sure how seriously you can take yourself when you're based on a toy. So much of it felt like a fan film, the way that, like, when there's a group of people who love this thing, and they get a little bit of money, and they go out and shoot, like, a fake trailer, and they put it up on YouTube, and they're excited because they got a really good, like, Cobra Commander costume, and so they're going to have them just walk in slow motion a lot. Like,
they sell DVDs of those at Comic-Con.
Yeah, and some of them are, you know, impressive to look at, but they're not stories.
They're demo reels.
There's a great sequence that's in all the trailers in the middle of the movie where these guys fight as they climb up and down a mountain. It's a bunch of ninjas fighting on ropes hanging off a mountain. And the movie for 10 minutes is great, and then it goes back to being garbage. And I say this not as somebody who holds G.I. Joe close to my heart. I grew up in the 80s, but I'm not like, hey, you guys got G.I. Joe wrong. That's not my issue with the movie. It's just not a good movie, unfortunately.
And you mentioned the 10 really good minutes. We're both on record as loving Kick-Ass.
Yes.
The Red Band trailer has been released.
Yes.
And already opinion is very mixed and there's early reviews in. But there is a shot in the trailer that I just, for lack of a better word, let's use the cliche, breathtaking. There's one shot that makes me want to see the film. Hit Girl's on top of the van.
Yeah.
The van is moving. Yeah. She does kind of a flip down into the window.
I kind of remember it.
And, like, kicks the guy. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, my God. That's kind of amazing. I'm looking forward to it, and I'm looking forward to finally liking Jim Carrey in something.
I'm looking forward to it in theory. In theory, because the whole thing looks kind of cheap to me.
And it's a different director.
Yeah.
And they're using the old Saw. I mean, they're taking a page from the Incredibles playbook.
Right.
The superheroes are banned or whatever.
And the only other movie I'll talk about is I watched on Netflix Instant. It's a movie from last year called The Comedy. And it is not funny, nor is it trying to be.
Oh, okay. It
stars
ironic?
Tim Heidecker from Tim and Eric Awesome Show, great job. And he plays sort of this aging hipster. It's a movie, a drama, that's entirely sort of about ironic distance. He's just this asshole piece of shit. Who his father is dying, he's going through divorce, and terrible things happen around him, and he's sort of unaffected by all of it. And the movie is mostly scene after scene of how uncomfortable can we make the audience. And it's an effective movie. I think it's a well-made movie. I think it's interesting. I don't ever want to see it again because I don't like to feel uncomfortable for the most part. So I can't say it's a bad movie. I think the people that it's for, it's really for, and everybody else might be left kind of cold by it. It made some 10 best lists last year, I know.
I am writing it down.
Okay.
And I am crossing it off my
list. A lot of good stuff lately has been showing up on Netflix, a bunch of stuff I missed last year that I'm excited to see.
And I love Netflix, and ask my students, I repeat this like the grandfather who's beset by dementia. I so envy them that they're in a generation that could take advantage of this. Although, the other day, I reached the conclusion that if you or I had had Netflix, we would have dropped out of school and never become anything, not that we are anything, but we would have become less than the nothing we are now. And I would be living in my parents' basement and doing anything.
But seeing Spring Breakers at 10 a.m., so...
Maybe drunk. Yeah. Maybe, in the alternate universe, I'm drunk at Spring Breakers. That I would have done any chore just so they didn't cut off the Netflix.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking about giving Hulu Plus a try.
Okay. Man. I'm just annoyed that I have to subscribe to all these different things. And I guess the alternative is to cancel cable, because then it's a wash if you subscribe to Netflix and Hulu and Amazon Prime or whatever.
And then Patrick told me today that Warner Archives is starting their own streaming service. And as those of you who read Unsung know, I've sort of become addicted to Warner Archives. So now do I want to pony up $10 a month for that? Because on the Roku player that I got over spring break, there is a silent movie channel that you can subscribe to.
Interesting.
Vase is bleeding me dry.
Does that cost money, or is it
all
public?
You betcha.
Okay, I didn't know if it was all like public domain stuff.
That's a subscription too. Yeah. Yeah. I got to see an old episode of Groucho Marx, You Bet Your Life for free.
Good.
So there was that.
Good. All right, you want to talk about Planet of the Apes?
Yes, and I wanted to preface this because a sci-fi spectacular or two ago, Rusty Nails, showed Planet of the Apes as part of the sci-fi spectacular, and I hadn't seen it in a long time. And I believe we both commented at the time, and these marathons are famous for their ironic douchebaggery and drunks and things, and we've commented on the people who sit behind us and stuff. Planet of the Apes still plays. Planet of the Apes still plays for a big audience, and I was really surprised by that, but I was happy about that because I think it's a great movie.
I think it's a really good movie. I think it has greatness in it. I really like it, so I'm not going to sit here and bash Planet of the Apes, but watching it this time reminded me of the first time I'd seen Star Wars in about 15 years when they did the reissue in like 97. It had been years since I'd seen Star Wars. And so I went to the theater and I sat down, and my memory of Star Wars must not have been accurate because I thought, oh my gosh, this is two robots fucking around in the desert for like a half hour. Nothing happens in Star Wars. Planet of the Apes has a lot of that.
I think you're getting to the first thing I wanted to talk about.
Okay.
That one of the reasons why I think this is a great film is, and we've talked about this endlessly, and I thought it was interesting that this week on the website, there was a lot of nostalgia. And I think it was generated spontaneously because I didn't talk to you. And right. A lot of us were talking about things from our childhood, your first action movie, the first time I saw Saturday Night Live. So again, as we've discussed endlessly, this film was really important in my childhood. And I remember seeing it for the first time on the CBS Wednesday night movie where I saw most of my movies. But hold on, my point, and I do have one, is... your memory of a movie is not the movie. And when you go back and revisit it, what I found this time is I think what you found. That spaceship, desert, let's trek is endless.
Yeah.
And in a weird way, I enjoyed it because my memory of the film is the last 45 minutes.
Right.
And that's the part you remember.
Right.
And I also like revisiting it. But I began to think that because parts of this film were incredibly expensive, because it's a lot of extras and a lot of costumes, there is a generation of makeup people in Hollywood who got their start working on this film because Chambers literally trained this army of makeup neophytes. And the film was so expensive, originally they weren't going to make it because in Rod Serling's original script, it was futuristic and the monkeys were flying around. And it was the producer who said, Franklin J. Schaffner. One of them said, if we make their society primitive,
yeah.
Right? So this was a very expensive film. Could it be that showing three actors walking around the Colorado desert is much cheaper?
I think so. I mean, that was because I had read about that prior to watching it, and I watched some of the documentary, and so that was in my head as I watched it, that, oh, you can kind of see where they were cost-cutting.
Or is it because deep down they knew that the secret, the halfway through the film reveal, is so amazing that they really wanted to string you along? I mean, we are given acres of foreshadowing.
Yeah, maybe, but how much stock could they really put in that reveal when the movie is called Planet of the Apes? It's not a, you know, it's not a surprise. It's at some point there are going to be apes.
Think about this. Wouldn't that have been a surprise?
A much better title, Planet of the Ape.
Angry people walking out of the theater. God damn it! I've been roped
again.
Don't
you see? We're the apes.
Darwin was wrong. Whatever. Here's the other reason why I really liked the first 45 minutes.
Yeah.
And it was only recently that I began to think about this. Charlton Heston is an interesting actor. This has come up before.
Kindly.
The first shitting on the classics column was the Ten Commandments.
Yeah.
And Saturday night, like clockwork, ABC showed the Ten Commandments.
I still have never seen.
For those of you following me on Twitter, I gave a half-hearted attempt at live tweeting the movie.
Okay.
I started. I gave up after about an hour. And I did a column on The Greatest Show on Earth, and Charlton Heston's in that. Charlton Heston is a very, very strange actor. Let's leave it at that. But watching it again, one of the things I like about the first 45 minutes is it really gives you a chance to become acquainted with his philosophy, which I think is interesting. He got on the spaceship because he's a misanthrope. He hates humanity. He thinks there has to be something better. And the other guys argue with him, and there's all this sort of philosophical discussion. I really like that because it establishes, I think, a hero that, at least at that time, Charlton Heston wasn't used to playing. And the entire adventure, sort of along the lines of Joseph Campbell, we get the adventure that we're ready for, becomes fate's attempt to humanize him and to change his mind about his original position. And I really like that.
Right, but then he ends up being validated by the end, right?
But isn't his abject anger, or I don't know how you would characterize his shouting, isn't that too an affirmation that he's come to appreciate?
Sure. What you're describing is Rod Serling, like, through and through. That's every episode of The Twilight Zone.
Yes, and
we
gotta
teach this guy a lesson, you know?
I wish we could be more clear, because the script has many fingerprints on it, and they kept hiring people to rewrite it.
Yeah.
Now, today I read that all the stuff I don't like was the last rewrite.
Okay.
And it wasn't Michael Wilson. Rod Serling had his fingers on it, and then Michael Wilson rewrote the dialogue, and then there was this third guy. And the third guy put in all the snot-nosed wiseacre-ness.
Okay.
The dearly departed.
Monkey, I didn't
my God. Although apparently the see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil, which I actually like. And say what you want, in a theater, it really plays. That was Schaffner on the set improvising. Yeah. That Rod Serling, I think, did something that not enough people give him credit for, because I'm a big Rod Serling fan. I've read the book by Pierre Boulez, and I'm probably not pronouncing his last name correctly. And the book is very different in that the book presents us with an astronaut who sort of receives this diary as sort of a message in a bottle, although it's in outer space, so it's not in a bottle. Space diary. And the bookend of the book is this astronaut reading the character who would become Taylor's diary. And so the book has a big surprise built in. And Serling recognized immediately there's no way you could pull that off in a movie. And even if you did, it would be anticlimactic and dumb. So he came up with the movie equivalent of something that would shock people. And again, I don't mean to spoil anything, but the astronaut gets the diary. He's reading about this astronaut who's sent back to an ape society and all the things that happens with Taylor. Obviously, we don't get the kicker from the movie. And at the end of the book, it is revealed that the astronaut reading the diary is an ape.
Okay.
Because we're humans, right. So we assumed it, right?
Got it.
So I really give Serling credit for reading it and going, well, not that,
right?
But something. And then, of course, in the Tim Burton version, when it first came out, I could kind of figure it.
No, you can't.
Okay, so I'm...
No.
It makes no sense.
again, not to get into the Tim Burton one, because I want to stick with the 68, but...
They play a similar...
The 68 movie is a movie that's entirely about ideas and philosophy and religion versus science. That's what the whole movie is. And Tim Burton said, I'm going to reimagine it, by making it a movie about nothing. And so it's a movie about nothing. It has very impressive makeup effects by Rick Baker. Unbelievable. But it's about nothing. And then somebody said, hey, the other one ends with a twist, but we can't use the same twist because people know that one. So let's just arbitrarily have this twist that makes no goddamn sense.
And speaking of the twist, because this angered me for a while, and maybe it's just that the movie's so old, no one cares. We are right now staring at this object to art that we've discussed before. It is an almost life-size ape head that I somehow convinced myself I needed. And it looks like Roddy McDowell, and it's very beautiful, and there's, you know, monkey hair, and it holds a box set of the Planet of the Apes films. The version of the box set that came out before the monkey head,
yes,
was in a cardboard box.
Yes, I had that one.
And the individual DVD of Planet of the Apes had the ending spoiled on the back of the keep case. Hey, have you ever seen this film? It has a famous twist. Don't look at the back of the box. And I've seen other iterations where it's spoiled on the menu.
Nice.
Like, what should we have on the menu? I don't know, a Statue of Liberty coming out of the sand? That's all I got. I can't think of anything
else. It's a pretty
else.
Famous twist. I feel like a lot of people do know it by now, but yeah. Again, new generations might not.
And unlike other films, yeah. I think this, I say it's great, you say it's very good, and I would still say that if there was no twist.
Sure.
I don't think it's, for lack of a better word, because I like this film, I don't think it's like The Sixth Sense.
Right.
Which is almost wholly
right.
dependent on the twist.
Yes.
I think it's a little candy at the end of an otherwise entertaining film.
Yeah, I don't think it makes or breaks the movie at all. Watching it this time, I was really thinking about, you know, the movie has this reputation for being kind of silly, because it has a title that maybe is goofy, and people remember the, you know, it's a bunch of people in ape suits, and it got turned into a Saturday morning cartoon, and it's a bunch of toys, and there were all these sequels, and they got progressively, quote-unquote, sillier, even though I really like the sequels. I really like this whole series, because I've said this before, I compared it to, like, the Saw series, because the longer it goes on, and the fewer people are seeing the movies, the weirder it gets,
oh, yeah.
and the more interesting it gets.
The what they attempted for escape was like,
yeah.
oh, who came up with that?
yeah.
But although, if you think about it, at the end of Beneath, well...
Right. We gotta do something.
But I've always really liked Beneath, too.
Yeah, it's dark.
Even I mean, though I so wish Charlton Heston had given them more than 2 days. Because you know James Franciscus...
You got me for the beginning and the end.
You know James Franciscus is... Anyway.
Of course. So it has this crazy reputation for being this silly campy, and Charlton Heston is in it, and we all do the impression, and get your paws off me, you know. So it has this reputation, but you sit down to watch it, and it's actually like this really thoughtful science fiction movie that, in a way, is sort of couched in the science fiction that came before, because you're coming out of, like, the 50s and early 60s, where science fiction was a little bit silly, minus a few classics.
Also, the trope, it has to start with a spaceship.
Right. But this comes out the same year as 2001, and I'm not comparing it to 2001, but here you have these two very sort of serious science fiction movies that really try and take their premises seriously.
Yeah.
It's actual science fiction. It's yes. not just spaceships and monkey suits. This is actual science fiction, and I don't think it always has been recognized as such.
And both films ask the eternal science fiction question.
What happened to the Statue of Liberty?
What is it that makes us human?
Right.
What is it that makes us a human being? You mentioned all the spin-offs and iterations. I do want to mention, when I was but a lad, it was a television series.
Yes.
On Friday nights. And
for like 3 months, maybe?
And I love Planet of the Apes so much. I was there every Friday night, and it started bad, and it just got worse. I've read interviews with the actors where it's like, we signed on to be part of Planet of the Apes. And every episode became, we're running away from something, and we stop somewhere, and we have an adventure. They said it became The Fugitive in ape makeup.
Were the apes the heroes of the show?
No, the humans. There were two two more astronauts.
What? They just keep showing up to this crazy
popular
planet,
alternate right? dimension. And they're wearing, and it was done so cheaply on the back lot, and I think it was canceled after 3 months. But then some wily packager took every episode of the TV series and cut two of them together mm-hmm. into a TV movie. And they'll still show up every once in a while, and they all have these ungainly titles. Suspense and Adventure on the Planet of the Apes. Okay, that's the one with the
Killing
wagon.
Time on the Planet yeah. of the Apes.
So that's the way they're seen now. And I love Planet of the Apes, but I think I bailed after three yeah. episodes because it was like going to a theme park and seeing the Planet of the Apes attraction where the guy in the ape makeup, well, you were taking tickets on the Tilt-A-Whirl right. last week, and now you're going to be in the ape stunt show or something.
And the show came out on DVD, right?
One of the many bonus features, okay. he said, pointing to the almost life-size ape head, is every episode of the TV series, not as those made-for-TV movies, right. and every episode of the cartoon.
Wow.
The cartoon, interestingly enough, did go with future apes.
Okay.
There's cycles and rocket ships and things.
Well, it doesn't cost money, I guess, to draw that stuff.
Can you draw a rocket? Yeah. Okay, it's in the future.
I was surprised at how much of the movie feels more relevant today than I think it might have even 20 years ago. I think all the issues that they're talking about are going to be relevant, you know, forever. But the way that maybe the last 10 years have gone as sort of the war on science is being waged by a certain faction of the country, how much of that is reflected in the movie, in the discussion of science versus religion? I'm going to deny facts because that cancels my beliefs that, you know.
And we hate Dr. Zayas so much because of his smugness.
Right.
And I've always had a problem with this. No. And he's in charge.
Right. And, you know, he's revealed to be a hypocrite, which I think is also very telling.
But because of Maurice Evans, who has a delightful voice, that part originally was supposed to be Edward G. Robinson.
I think.
Who was getting on in years and felt that he couldn't deal with the makeup regiment. And
Dr. Zayas, eh?
Where's your Moses now? See, where's your Moses now? On one of the supplements or on the documentary?
It's on the documentary.
Behind the Planet of the Apes?
I believe so. Unless that's
besides,
another TV movie.
Besides the Planet of the Apes. I have it on the shelf.
Yeah.
There's a wonderful documentary about these films.
It's like over 2 hours long.
And they actually show the test footage with James Brolin looking very
as
strange.
Caesar. But it's bad make. They were obviously right. going for something either cheap or very sort of human looking.
Edward G. Robinson looks like something out of Alice in Wonderland. Yeah. It's very strange.
But at least they tried to make him look like a monkey. I mean, James yes. Brolin has like a little bit of an eyebrow and maybe a nose, but it's nothing compared
it
to...
It screams screen test. Yeah. Screen test. That Edward G. Robinson was supposed to play Dr. Zayas, which I think it's really sad that he didn't, because recently Adam Riske and I attended the Sci-Fi Spectacular and got to see Soylent Green on a big screen, which I had real definite memories of from the CBS Wednesday night movie. And I really reevaluated it. Again, when I saw it at the Sci-Fi Spectacular, because I really liked it at the Sci-Fi Spectacular, mostly for Edward G. Robinson, and what a great actor he was, and how I wish that he had been in Planet of the Apes.
But yeah, the Dr. Zayas they have is great, and doesn't Paul Williams show up as...
Not in this one, in
right.
the final sequel,
right.
he shows up as Virgil.
Virgil, that's right.
Ape. Shall not kill ape.
That's a really good Paul Williams.
Well, I don't know if I brought it up on the podcast, but there's a documentary out there that could have been life-changing, but the filmmaker went a different direction.
Yeah.
Here's a subject that's fascinating. I'm going to make the movie about me. But yeah, you're talking about how all the sequels got more and more batshit.
Yeah.
Battle for the Planet of the Apes is just fun out of budget.
Yeah.
It's like, here's $3, go make one. Let's have a 3-foot tall orangutan. who in the middle of the film sings You and Me Against the World.
So I do. I really like Planet of the Apes. I feel like I undersold how much I like Planet of the Apes. I just watching it this time, I had such an issue with some of the pacing that I was like, is this a great movie or is this just a really good one that strives for greatness?
I agree about the first 45 minutes. Yeah. But again, I can't argue with my 8-year-old self. It has become one of the reasons why I like it, that it really does take us a long time to get to those weird scarecrows and the weird waterfall.
And I guess I just wish that some of... I wouldn't have a problem if it was like, hey, the apes don't show up until 40 minutes into the movie. I would be okay with that if those first 40 minutes were maybe better spent. It's just a lot of, like, walking around and swimming naked and...
Maybe... Well, no, because I just watched it. I have to disagree.
Yeah, no, that's fine.
It is a lot. I'm not denying that it's a lot.
Yeah.
At this point, I'd just like to mention John Chambers, and again, I think I might have mentioned
Star of Argo.
Yeah. This film represents a sea change in makeup in Hollywood for a number of reasons, but most of it having to do with foam latex appliances and people seeing what they can do. And oddly enough, I always thought one of the stupid reasons they made the Tim Burton remake was greenlit is that a newer generation of movie fans, A, would have a problem watching anything from the 60s, because as we all know, movies are food, and if they're too old, they'll poison you and you'll die. But that the special effects were not up to their expectations, even though I so willingly suspend my disbelief when the apes show up, especially Roddy McDowall and Kim Hunter. It has never bothered me that the mouths aren't perfect.
And that's, I think, really the only major issue you could say. If you're going to nitpick to that degree, like, yeah, their mouths don't always move. But watching the Tim Burton one, and again, the makeup effects in that movie are really, really good. And there's all kinds of different apes, and that's really neat. And I absolutely agree that that seems to be the reason they remade it, was think of what we could do with the makeup. But I wouldn't say it's considerably better than the original. I think the original still really holds up.
No, 100 times better. Yeah. I see the Tim Burton remake, excuse me, reimagining, universally reviled film, as a Rick Baker test reel,
right.
Not a narrative.
No.
Because it doesn't work as a narrative at all.
The only enjoyment you could get is looking at the cool makeup. But again, I don't think it's so much better than the original that it warrants existing. I think the original, again, except for the mouths not always moving, I think the makeup in the original still really holds up.
So another thing, recently we were recommending books that had taught us a lot about film on the website, and I recommended A Certain Tendency of the Hollywood Cinema by Robert Ray, and he has this theory that after World War II the audience bifurcates into the naive audience and the informed audience. Watching Planet of the Apes again, I was struck by, and I'm not sure if many films do this anymore, because I think, if anything, modern films really want to make sure that the simplest and the stupidest person in the audience gets something. But this goes back to what I was saying about arguing with my 8-year-old self. I'm not going to say this is a family film, although back then most films were assumed to be okay for the family. I was struck by how much this film gives every age group something that they might go to the movies for. So I really like what you said previously, that you can see this film as an allegory, as a conversation about, are we going to follow the lead of science and facts, or are we going to base our lives on superstition and religion? And there will always be these arbiters of the two, and there'll be these guardians that sort of try to and obviously if you're a brainiac or if you're looking for something thoughtful, you'll find it. But you can look at this film through the eyes of an 8-year-old, and I don't want to say it's a boy's adventure because I use that term too much, but it has all these things that kids would really go for. Think of how many chases there are in it.
Right.
When someone's chased around, and people get on horses, and there's shooting. There's some shooting at certain points.
Plus the apes look cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
That... you really have the possibility here for a film that appeals to everyone, like a circus. Children from 8 to 80.
And you had said that the movie still played. Now, that was with a science fiction crowd, a right. crowd who is perhaps accustomed to seeing repertory stuff or has an affection for this movie because it has influenced other movies that they've loved or whatever. Do you think that a sort of a general contemporary audience would have the patience for this movie?
I do.
Okay.
I really do. Although you're right to point out that the sci-fi spectacular audience is not a normal audience
right.
by any means. But we've seen this at The Massacre, too, that there are some films that have such a reputation that they command a little bit more respect mm-hmm. than a film that we might be showing because it's junk and we want to laugh at it. So part of it might be that there's a certain reverence because, come on, it's Planet of the Apes. But also, I suspected that there are people who are here because they're science fiction fans, and that I didn't detect a lot of derisive laughter.
Sure.
The laughter that I heard was intended by the film
right.
and almost seemed like appreciative laughter.
Sure. I just wonder as I watched it, because it is, like I said, a slower-paced movie, even once the apes show up. There are cool chases and stuff, but again, a large part of the movie does boil down to sort of these ideological conversations, and I just don't know how much, and this is, I'm not just trying to knock, you know, oh, kids today with their Nintendo, they hate everything. It just seemed like a talkier movie than I think people expect going in. Again, and this goes back to the movie's reputation as being sort of this Saturday morning kids goofy thing, when actually it's a serious science fiction movie, and I think that might catch some people off guard, and they might not have the patience for it.
But now I begin to think, once you bring that up, that before I mentioned, maybe they did a remake because Planet of the Apes is a known quantity, and certainly the studio wants to exploit anything that they can exploit to make money. But if one of the reasons why Tim Burton made that thing was because the special effects were not up to par anymore in people's minds, maybe the other reason they made it is, as you suggested, modern audiences could not sit through that first 45 minutes because my memory, my dim memory that I've tried to, you know, forget of the remake is the first part is lightning fast.
Yeah, I think it opens with Marky Mark in a spaceship, and then he lands on the Planet of the Apes, and then
he crashes. He yeah. runs through the jungle for 5 minutes. Okay,
right.
That's severely abbreviated.
Get to the apes, and yet my memory again—I haven't seen it in a long time either—is that the remake tests my patience a lot more than the original.
The remake tests my patience once we get to Ape City.
Yeah,
and it just.
And the thing is, I don't even know that, like, I'm not 100% opposed to the idea of remaking Planet of the Apes. In theory, I'm opposed to remaking most movies, honestly, so whatever. But I think there are things in Planet of the Apes, not that can be improved upon, but that you can look at differently, or as we've been talking about how the movie is about this discussion between the two things. You can sort of take
the original movie.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. But
the remake certainly
it's about nothing,
discussion
but,
about
but you can sort of update that conversation and where are we at now and the makeup, you know, I think there's a way to do it that it could have been not an improvement over the original, but just, you know, an interesting alternative, the way that some of the best remakes are. They don't negate the original. They're just like, hey, here's a different take on this. But the Tim Burton one is not that at all.
And
at
I just remembered something.
Okay.
That I had completely forgot. Every year, I like to attend Wonderfest. I believe one year I did some Like You Were
yeah,
There
yeah, yeah.
about it. Wonderfest is amazing and great, and you should all go. And at one point, Heath, love you. Heath threw out the idea that Louisville, Kentucky, is about midway between where I live and where he lives, and that maybe one year we could meet in the middle. That would be fun. One year, I went to Wonderfest, and one of the special guests was Linda Harrison.
Oh.
I have been in an audience with Linda Harrison, and she told wonderful stories about the film, but here's what I want to bring to the podcast. Almost the entire thing boiled down to, I was Richard Zanuck's girlfriend.
Yeah.
And it's almost refreshing that someone on the convention circuit would just be very honest about it.
Right.
She has never felt very comfortable as an actress. She talked about how great it was being his girlfriend because he was rich and he went to all these great places and everything was first class and it was great. That she was very uncomfortable making the movie because she felt that she wasn't an actress, but that ultimately I think that informs the performance, that she's very good at playing that part because she's not trying to streep it up.
Sure.
Let's say.
Sure.
She's a natural. Also, I was talking about how this film has something for everyone.
Which was the joke I was going to make when you were saying
that. In 1968, she's easy on the eyes.
That was the joke I was going to, was if you were 15, you had
And she's Nova. Still easy on the eyes. Yeah. Linda Harrison's very nice, very handsome woman. She was very, very generous with her time with the fans, and she was one of the good ones. One of Risky's columns recently was about getting autographs and stuff, and
yeah.
I thought that was great, and I hope he continues that, because he does a lot more of that than you and I do. At a recent Days of the Dead convention, there was part of the dealer's room, you all know what I'm talking about, where it was the celebrities, and I kept calling it Sadness Alley.
Yeah.
Sadness Alley.
But we met that guy who was in The Thing, whose name I don't remember right now.
He plays Nalls?
I think he stopped you and said, do I know you? And just recently I was rewatching The Warriors, and he's in The Warriors, and I had forgotten that. I wish I would have brought it up.
And I took the opportunity to compliment him, because I pointed out, and you know, you want to say something nice, because come on.
Right.
No one was frequenting that part, and you just feel that... I congratulated him because I thought it was a great acting challenge because 15 minutes into that movie till the end, you have to be completely scared and on your edge and to do that and then stop and then do that and then stop. But as I shared with you, him saying he thought he recognized me, I began to think was a convention gambit. To get people to your table.
I hope not. I think he was a little bit buzzed. He had a glass of wine. Oh, yeah.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I didn't notice that at all.
Yeah. So, who knows?
Hey, do I know you? Were we in a movie together? Were you the same?
Yes, I'm Wilfred Brimley.
I look a little bit like
bringing up Richard Zanna, and this does no good to you, podcast audience, so I apologize, but this life-size ape bust that we're sitting in front of looks a lot, I think, like late-period Richard Zanuck. When you see him in, like, interviews and stuff, he started to more and more resemble a Planet of the Apes creation.
I don't think he got work, but he was obviously on some sort of diet regimen.
Oh, my gosh. Was,
and, you know, when you get old, sometimes you thin out. But the big thing was the perma-tan, leathery skin.
Right, against the white hair. Stretched across the skull.
Google Roddy McDowell in the Planet of the Apes films. And then Google Richard Zanuck, old. Also, this is a complete tangent. Can we talk about this for 1 minute?
Yeah, we might as well.
Lately, when I Google the name of an actress...
Okay.
You know how Google suggests other searches?
Yeah.
I've noticed lately, this is the creepiest thing on earth. One of the suggestions is always name of actress feet.
Really?
And I swear to you, I've never clicked, I've never touched, I've never gone there. Are there people who...
Obviously.
Sure, and I don't know how... Sure. You like Jennifer Connelly, but have you ever seen her feet? Are there such people?
For sure.
Okay, we've never done this before, podcast listeners. Here's your homework assignment. I'm serious. If you've made it this far, I'm a teacher. I'm giving you homework. Follow one of these feet searches. And on the comments for this podcast, tell us what you found. Because I'm not.
It's going to be like... George C. Scott in Hardcore. It's just like,
oh my God! One of the cable channels has been showing Firestarter lately.
Yeah, HBO shows it a lot.
George C. Scott's finest comic performance. He just didn't tell anyone. Oh, yeah. So good in that. One more thing I wanted to talk about.
Yes.
And
Linda Harrison's feet.
I will not. I will not do the search. I think maybe it's become a cliche. Maybe here's a third reason they remade it. This film's score is so interesting. Mm-hmm. And so, is that Jerry Goldsman?
I think so.
Don't hate us if we get it wrong, but I think it's Goldsman. So different, and I so applaud the filmmakers for realizing that this film was a little different and that you wanted something. And I think that style quickly becomes a cliche. Because I remember in the early 70s, every television show aped it. Because I got the feeling it was easier to write, required fewer instruments. It's got a lot of sort of African-American percussion. And these... And that it's very percussion and string based. I don't remember any piano, although I'm not musical. That you have this very unique score that quickly becomes the music for every shitty drama series in the early 70s.
And I'm sure you're right. I'm sure it seems like the kind of thing that's easy to imitate, mostly because I'm sure people think, hey, we can just make it up, you know. But obviously, a lot of thought went into it, and it's really effective. And again, not to go back to the remake, but I'm pretty sure it was Danny Elfman doing the music, and very much just sort of rips off, you know, what the original was doing.
And during that...
But, you know, reimagines it.
Universally revived? That, in that perhaps interminable first 45 minutes, I would argue that the music is contributing to the sense of dread and foreboding and foreshadowing as they get closer to the reveal. I like Planet of the Apes.
I do too.
I like The Tin Man.
I do too. And it's, again, if you haven't seen all of the Planet of the Apes movies, I really recommend the whole series. You can pick up the DVDs and a lot of times the Blu-rays pretty cheap and work your way through the whole series. I did it once in a weekend when my wife was away. I ordered Domino's thinking I can't afford not to eat Domino's. It wasn't good. And watched all the Planet of the Apes movies.
And, the wife went away, and Patrick very quickly said, I see a weekend of Planet of the Apes, cheap pizza, and Google foot searches.
You would not believe the feet on Liv Ullmann.
The feet of the apes are actually kind of interestingly constructed. One more thing about watching all the films, which is the last thing on my little list I wanted to mention.
All right.
You watched all the films in a weekend.
Yes.
And I would certainly suggest that. The one thing I never got to do as a kid, once they started making sequels, and once they started to appear on television, and once you got this sort of second wave of the apes in the late 70s with the TV show and the cartoon and everything, 20th Century Fox released all five to theaters as a marathon. And I think you've seen the poster because it's sort of famous.
I have the poster. It's up in my office, right? I Want You to Go Ape?
Yeah. It's one of the gorillas.
Yeah.
I Want You to Go Ape. And they showed all five films in a row in a movie theater. Oh.
Yeah, that would be super cool.
What I would. So, Rusty.
Yeah.
Portage.
Somebody at the patio. Somebody. Come on.
Music Box. All five in a row. Yeah. I really think people would go.
I do too. But again, it's such a weird trajectory because it starts so classy. You know, like the first movie is really an A-list movie. And then it gets, like, B-list, and then by the end it's kind of C-list.
At the end of battle, it's like, we're in these junky cars. You know, junky cars.
Ape cars.
Ape. Do not kill ape.
Now do swan.
I'm trying to think of a famous line from Phantom
of the Paradise. There's no real famous line. You could just say Winslow a lot.
Listen, Winslow.
Nice. I like it.
It's pretty good. Uh-oh. I have to go get the phone. We're done.
It's apes. See you guys next week. Who likes bananas?